Australia is the greatest nation on earth. And at the referendum last year, Australians told the elites they want to keep it that way. Is 2024 the year mainstream Australians continue to secure our way of life, or will the elites strike back? In season 3 of Australia's Future, former Prime Minister Tony Abbott will share his unique insight on the future of the Australian way of life. Hello, Tony, and g'day to all of our listeners. Great to be back for another episode of Australia's Future with Tony Abbott. Today we'll be discussing some key issues, including the future of the AUKUS deal, given the submarine challenges. We'll be discussing Tony Abbott's comments regarding President Trump and Ukraine. And we'll also be discussing the Irish referendum, the very significant no vote delivered there, plus many other key issues. Tony, great to be back for another chat.
Thanks, Dan. Wonderful to be here as always.
Great. Well, let's start with AUKUS and the issues pertaining to the acquisition of the nuclear submarines. The Prime Minister has said that AUKUS is going to continue, that it's not under threat, despite the what appears to be a potentially significant delay to the provision of the Virginia-class nuclear-powered submarines from the United States. Tony, can you talk us through what do you think is happening here? Is this just a normal sort of issue that might come up in the acquisition of any sort of defence materiel, or are you concerned that the capacity for us to acquire those subs may actually be now at risk?
The first point to make, Dan, is that the AUKUS deal is of immense importance. Not only does it lock us in to our traditional military alliances with the United States and the United Kingdom, but it's also a sign that the principal countries of the Anglosphere want to work together for the greater peace and security of the wider world. So it's a very significant agreement. I reckon that it's at least the most significant strategic agreement that Australia has made since the ANZUS Treaty back in the early 1950s. So I don't want anyone to be under any misapprehensions about just how important AUKUS is. Now, obviously, the flagship, so to speak, of AUKUS is the nuclear submarine arrangements. And it is critical that Australia get a very effective next-generation submarine as soon as possible. It does concern me that apparently the United States is slowing down its own acquisition of the Virginia-class submarines, because I think that will impact on delivery timetables for us. And frankly, we need a better submarine deterrent as soon as possible, preferably today, if not today, tomorrow, if not tomorrow, the day after, and so on. And I must say, the slowdown in America's own acquisition program does reflect what strikes me as the disconnect between people's rhetoric about the urgency of our strategic circumstances and the relative lack of urgency in the rearmament of the West in the face of those circumstances. What's happening in Ukraine is of itself diabolical. The Russian dictator's attempt to extinguish the independence and freedom of Ukraine. But should it succeed, the ramifications for the whole of Europe are immense. Then, of course, we've got the ongoing difficulties in the Middle East, which could easily become much worse very quickly. And we've got the ongoing belligerence of Beijing towards Taiwan, which again could explode very quickly into much more serious military complications. So the world has not been as dangerous as this for many decades, and yet having banked the peace dividend of the 1990s after the fall of the Berlin Wall, it seems that we are very reluctant to get into the business yet again of serious armament, and yet we need serious armament because the only thing that bullies understand is strength. And the best way to deter a bully is to make it crystal clear to the bully that his aggression will not succeed, that he will pay a very high price for any aggression that he cares to undertake.
One thing I can't get my head around, Tony, and maybe you can help me out, I don't understand why this takes so long. So we're told that under the best case scenario, we'll be getting these nuclear powered subs by 2032. And it's not until 2042 that we'll have the capacity to produce our own British designed AUKUS class submarines in Adelaide. Why can't we get this done sooner? Is it, I can't comprehend. If these dangers, clearly everybody understands these dangers. To me, it just seems unacceptable to be waiting a minimum of 7 or 8 years to get this acquisition. By then, it's going to be too late, isn't it?
Well, I probably should also remind our listeners that had we pushed ahead with the Japanese submarine deal in 2014 and 2015, we would be getting our first Japanese submarines about now, which would be much more satisfactory, because while the ultimate AUKUS submarine will be a better product, there's no doubt about that. Yep. Nuclear submarines are just far better in terms of their range, their endurance, and ultimately their stealth than diesel electric subs. A new and upgraded submarine would certainly be better than extending the life of our rather tired Collins class submarines. So that's the first point to make.
Yep.
The second point to make is I absolutely share your frustration. Many times I would say to our defence planners as Prime Minister, look, whole classes of warship were conceived, designed, built and put into service in the Second World War in a couple of years, let alone a couple of decades. Yep. And the extraordinary slothfulness that seems to infect military planning, procurement planning, is a mystery to me. And I think at times like this, a dangerous mystery, an absolutely dangerous mystery. The other difficulty, which I think is unique to Australia, is our determination to fiddle, our insistence that everything be somehow retwigged for our own conditions, as if the atmosphere of the southern hemisphere is different from the northern hemisphere, or the water of the southern hemisphere is somehow different from the southern hemisphere. I mean, it is bamboozling, and I think potentially alarming that we haven't been able to develop a culture in our own defence procurement of simply taking the best that is currently available from our friends and allies and getting it quickly, if needs be, built overseas. And then if we are determined, as we probably should be, to build up our own defence industrial base, then down the track, building it in Australia, but not in ways which compromise our ability to get the military equipment that we need as quickly as possible. Now, right now, there are two things, Dan, that I think we need to be doing. First of all, we need to be better deploying our existing defence assets. I think it's a scandal that we didn't respond positively to the American request for a frigate for the Red Sea. I look out from my office window over Garden Island, our principal naval base, and I've got to say, I can tell using my own eyes that our frigates are not fully deployed.
Yeah.
They are not fully deployed. They are mostly sitting at Garden Island, and why couldn't one of them be at the Red Sea right now and for an extended period of time? So we should be better deploying our existing assets. I think we should be rotating ships and planes through bases in southern Japan. I think that would send a very clear message to Beijing that it's not going to be China versus Taiwan, 1.4 billion people versus 25 million, but aggression across the straits could easily be China versus the world, or certainly China versus a powerful alliance of determined democracies. And frankly, I don't see why we aren't rotating some of our fast jets through the British bases in Cyprus, where they could help with these airstrikes on the Houthis that are causing so many problems in the Red Sea. So So I think there's a lot more that we can be doing right now that would indicate our seriousness as a country and that would contribute to the overall security of the world. And Dan, don't get me started on what more we should be doing for Ukraine. I mean, plainly we should be giving them more Bushmasters. Plainly we should have given them the Hawkeye light armoured vehicle. Plainly we should have made the Taipan helicopters that we were phasing out available to the Ukrainians. So we are talking very tough, but that's not how we're acting. Mm. We are quite rightly pointing to the serious strategic dangers we face as a country and as a Western alliance, but our actions belie our words, and that's one of the many things which right now must be emboldening those who wish us harm.
And building on that, Tony, you had a pretty wide-ranging interview with Paul Kelly at The Australian published earlier this week.
Mm-hmm.
It goes to a lot of the points that you were just making. You were fairly laudatory towards President Biden's State of the Union as it relates to the Russia-Ukraine situation. And I think it'd be fair to say express some reservations about a Trump presidency or a prospective Trump presidency as it relates to that particular matter. Can you let our viewers and listeners know who may not have read the article, what your main sort of points were to Paul Kelly?
Well, Dan, one thing I'm careful to be is not publicly critical of the leader of the free world, whether it's the current leader of the free world or the prospective leader of the free world. And I'm certainly not one of those people who are in the Trump derangement camp,
yep,
or indeed in the Trump fascination camp. I think that as president, Donald Trump did quite a lot of good things. I think he was a much better president than he's normally given,
yep,
credit for. But what does worry me is the isolationist tendencies which have always been present in the United States and which currently seem particularly strong inside elements of the Republican Party. Now, I can understand that America has really created the modern world. I mean, Britain was an exhausted titan after the Second and First World Wars. Britain really handed the baton of leadership to the United States. Thank God it did, and thank God the United States has carried the baton so wonderfully well for the last seven decades. But for America's massive expenditure of blood and treasure, the world would be nothing like as free, as fair, as rich, and as safe as it has until recently been. So all credit to America. Now, I can understand why many Americans think, well, other countries have benefited much more from all of this than we have. And that's true. Post-war Germany, post-war Japan, post-war Europe, the countries of East Asia, all of them have advanced amazingly thanks to the world order which America put in place and guarded and extended. So I can understand why Americans are a little impatient at the burdens they've been asked to carry, are a little resentful at the fact that the benefits have perhaps accrued disproportionately to others. But America remains the indispensable country. And if America were ever, at least in the short term, to turn aside from the burdens of leadership, it would be a much darker and more dangerous world. So really, what I was trying to do in my discussion with Paul Kelly was acknowledge how indebted we all are to America, to reassure the Americans that that debt is appreciated and cherished and valued, at least by some people in the wider world, to urge America not to lay down the burdens of leadership anytime soon, and at the same time, to encourage countries such as Australia and Britain, and particularly the continental Europeans, to do more in the defence of freedom.
Well, you were Prime Minister when Barack Obama was president, mm-hmm, and I think he did the wrong thing by you and Australia when he talked about the Great Barrier Reef and and went on that tangent. Mm-hmm. But I seem to recall, and I'm not going to get this quite right, but I seem to recall at the time reading reports of when you first met with him or his office, you said something to the effect of, I'm not here to ask you for more, but I'm here to thank you for your support, or something along those lines. You can correct me if I'm not right, but there was something like that. And I suspect that would have been unusual because the US would be so used to its allies and friends asking for more and more and more. But I think you've, in your actions, shown that, well, we are grateful. Is that right, what I'm saying?
That's more or less what happened, Dan. Yeah. To give you my version of what happened, as PM, I thought it would be best to begin my relationship with other national leaders by trying to say something to them that was true, that I could say in good conscience, and that they would want to hear. Mm. And I figured out that nearly everyone who goes in to see the President of the United States is there to demand something or to complain about something.
Yep.
And I didn't want to be a complainer.
Yep.
And I didn't want to be a demander. And as it happened, ISIL had just smashed its way out of Syria and was at the gates of Baghdad at the time. And this had happened with remarkable rapidity, really over the course of about 72 hours. And people were scrambling in Washington and elsewhere to know how to respond to this. And I just said to Barack Obama, look, anything that you would like done in response to this, Australia will be there in at least a commensurate way. Australia is here to help, not to demand or not to complain. And I think afterwards the Americans said to Kim Beazley, our then ambassador, and a very good ambassador, I should add, the Americans said to Kim Beazley, well, the world needs more Tony Abbotts. Now, I don't know that that was quite Barack Obama's instinct later on when he came to Brisbane and decided to talk about the Great Barrier Reef and the alleged threat of climate change. Yep. But nevertheless, at that time,
that seemed to be the... Did you ever get a chance to have a surf with him?
No, we did give him a surfboard, which he seemed very appreciative of, a surfboard embossed with the presidential crest made by one of the surfboard manufacturers in my electorate.
Right.
And he seemed quite chuffed by the gift, but I'm not sure he is actually a surfer himself. Okay. I mean, he grew up in Hawaii, but not everyone in Hawaii is a surfer, even though Hawaii is, in a sense, the birthplace of surfing.
Just to go back to Trump and Biden, there are those who argue, well, Putin invaded Ukraine on Biden's watch, and they may not have done that on Trump's watch. Well, he didn't do it on Trump's watch. Now, we'll never know what would have happened if Trump won in 2020.
Mm.
But isn't there sort of an argument that Trump, for all of his perhaps limitations, has shown a tendency to be quite direct with foreign leaders and also, you know, allies or enemies alike, and that Putin may have been less likely to invade Ukraine given Trump's unpredictable approach to diplomatic relations? What do you think of that perspective?
I think that's an arguable point. I think you're right. He was an unconventional president, and being unconventional adds an element of doubt and risk to adventurism by others. And certainly the scuttle from Kabul, which I think was probably very significant in making Putin think that he could get away with it, happened on Biden's watch, although an orderly departure from Afghanistan was indeed Trump's position as well. Look, regardless of what were the circumstances surrounding the Russian dictator's motivation, what he has done and is doing in Ukraine is simply wrong. I think aspects of it are undeniably evil. It must be resisted, and any abandonment of Ukraine in its hour of need would be a moral failure of catastrophic proportions and consequences by the West.
Tony, let's move on to another fascinating piece of international news from Ireland. It's been wildly underreported in the Australian media, I think, because it goes against the zeitgeist of the media class. On the 8th of March, there were two referenda held. The first was in relation to a proposal to what was said to expand the constitutional definition of a family to include quote-unquote durable relationships outside of marriage, in effect that would have heavily diluted the role of marriage in society. And the second proposal was to replace references to a woman's, quote, life within the home, end quote, and the constitutional obligation to endeavour to ensure that mothers shall not be obliged by economic necessity to engage in labour to the neglect of their duties in the home, end quote, and to replace that with a new gender-neutral article that basically erased references to women. Both of those proposals were summarily rejected. The first had a 68% no vote and the second a 74% no vote, and that was the highest no vote in the history of referenda in Ireland. Those who campaigned against it, and I just want to read this out to you just quickly, Tony. One of the lead campaigners who had opposed the moves, her name is Maria Steen, and she made this argument. This was back in 2022 or 23. She argued this, as in the referenda proposals, is the latest example of the gender-erasing mania that has gripped society of late. It started long ago with the erasure of feminine suffixes, and then it talks about, you know, replacing breastfeeding with chest feeding, removing expectant mothers with pregnant people and so forth. So the no case was not just about the particular details. It was about the broader woke identity politics and gender of the political class. I think it's fascinating at how significant the defeat was. And I'm just interested in your perspective, Tony, on what it says about the broader situation of Western societies.
Well, Dan, you're right. It has been very much underreported here in Australia. Indeed, it was only after it had been defeated that I even knew that these referenda were taking place. I guess what it says to me is that on topics where you ask the people, you're going to get a fairly conservative, common sense response. In countries which are essentially successful, and Ireland, like Australia, is a pretty successful society in terms of the daily life of most people, notwithstanding, you know, historical issues. Today, it's a pretty successful society. And if you ask the people in a successful society to change something, particularly something that goes to the heart of how they have traditionally seen themselves, there appears to be a reluctance to do so, unless there is some obvious difficulty. We've talked about this in the context of the Voice referendum in Australia. So look, I find the Irish result encouraging, because the people of Ireland have overwhelmingly rejected a woke-inspired change, and that is encouraging. On the other hand, I don't think any of us can be complacent about these results, because so much that happens in a sense regardless of the people. I mean, so many of the big social changes of recent times in this country haven't even been driven by the parliament, let alone by the people. They're things which have been driven effectively by the long march of the left through the institutions. I mean, the decolonisation, in inverted commas, of the school curriculum, the near universal flying of the Indigenous flag co-equally with the national flag. The people have never been asked about these things. The ubiquity of acknowledgements of country as if it belongs to some of us rather than all of us. I mean, these things have all crept in without the parliament ever being asked, let alone the people being asked. So what I think we've seen in Ireland, as we saw in Australia with The Voice, is the public being appropriately careful and cautious about change, which might have long-run ramifications for society, which might have a whole lot of unintended consequences. And I think the vote against The Voice in Australia was a vote against separatism fundamentally.
Division.
It wasn't just the detail or lack of detail of The Voice as such. It certainly wasn't a vote against consulting with the people affected before decisions are made.
Yep.
It was a vote against race-based or ancestry-based separatism, and I suspect the Ireland vote is a vote in favour of acknowledging the importance of families and recognising that some kind of formal bond, preferably legal and sacramental marriage, is very important in keeping families together.
Yeah, and what's so interesting to me, Tony, I mean, you and I have talked about the idea of peak, or you talk about peak insanity or peak woke, and it's not as if the Irish have voted always against social change. So just to give you a couple of examples, they voted overwhelmingly in favour of essentially making divorce easier by removing a time period before divorce could be initiated. They voted in favour of what was essentially an expansion of access to abortion by allowing the parliament to legislate, whereas previously it had been prohibited in the constitution. And they also voted in favour of same-sex marriage by about the same margin as what happened in Australia. So I think what you're sort of seeing, and I'm not suggesting those are what you would call quote-unquote woke issues per se, but you have seen, I think, in Western societies an element of social change that has in large part been endorsed by a majority of the electorate. But now I think what you're seeing with Brexit, with The Voice, with the Irish referenda, I would argue with Trump to an extent in 2016 and other developments in Europe, you are sort of seeing, well, hang on, things are going too far and these changes are now becoming actually fundamentally changing who we are and our way of life. So I'm sort of, I agree with you that the political class will always find a way to do what it wants unless you stop them. Mm. And that's the concern I have, is they just won't put votes to the people anymore.
Mm.
But I think it's encouraging that across Western society, we're starting to see some pushback.
And yeah, I think we should be encouraged as long as we don't become complacent. Back last year when we were talking about The Voice, I think you and I might have made the point that there was a big difference between the same-sex marriage plebiscite and the Voice referendum, because the same-sex marriage plebiscite was asking people, at least in some respects, to vote in favour of equality, whereas The Voice was, in important respects, asking people to vote in favour of inequality.
Yep.
So I thought that... I didn't think that the same-sex marriage plebiscite was in any way a kind of an augury in favour of The Voice, given that one was about equality, was claimed to be about equality, and the other was definitely about inequality, creating inequality. But what we really need, Dan, is we just need more people in leadership positions who are prepared more often to stand up for the enduring values and verities of our culture and our civilization, because it's the creeping wokeness that doesn't get put to a vote, which has been the real problem over the last couple of decades, and it's been the politeness, and I suppose the lack of conviction of people whose normal role it is to stand up for tradition, to stand up for precedent, to stand up for existing institutions, which has led us into our current predicament. I mean, the point I keep making, a majority that stays silent does not long remain a majority, and I think too many of us have been too quiet for too long, either through a surfeit of politeness or perhaps a lack of conviction.
I'll take us to our next topic and our last topic for today, Tony, which builds on that, which is these proposals that were just reported on today relating to so-called truth in advertising laws. Now, based on reports, the idea would be that the Australian Electoral Commission would be tasked with adjudicating on the truthfulness of election advertisements. This is, I think, one of the most significant attacks on our democracy and freedom of speech that you could possibly think of. The idea that you'd have a government body beyond the reach of the people that's going to be deciding what is truth and what not, is not truth, is deeply concerning. This also comes on the back of the government's proposed misinformation laws, which would empower the Australian Communications and Media Authority to come up with its definition of truth as it relates to misinformation online. I think this is retribution of the political class against the public for voting no on The Voice. And essentially what this will do is it'll go some of the way to outlawing political opposition to the Albanese government, because I don't think they have the confidence to win arguments in the public anymore, having lost The Voice. So I'm deeply concerned about what is happening. I'm interested in your thoughts and perspective on what these kind of laws might mean for debate in our country.
Well, there's a sense in which freedom of speech is the most fundamental of freedoms, because if we aren't free to speak our minds, we're not free to explore issues. We're not free to try to come to a better appreciation of truth. So it is the most fundamental of freedoms. And I think it is challenged, maybe threatened, by these sorts of measures. And I think that the public normally more than capable of seeing through hypocrisy, humbug, mendacity. I know my successor was very exercised by the so-called Medi-scare of the 2016 election campaign. The problem was not that Labor made a fairly outrageous scare campaign about Medicare. It was that the scare campaign was inadequately countered by the coalition at the time. And you know, the best antidote to falsehood is truth, not repression. Mm. And that's what all of these things seem to involve. They seem to involve trusting some godlike adjudicator more than you trust the good sense of the people to see the truth, to get behind the claims. And I would be deeply skeptical of all of this. Speech is never entirely free. I mean, there are laws against defamation, mm-hmm. as there should be. There are laws against creating a public nuisance, as there should be. But apart from that, speech should be free, and that is one of the fundamentals.
And look, if you're going to talk about truth in advertising and in political communication, I mean, you personally would be subject to some of the most egregious untruths and falsehoods in your political career, but I can't ever remember you saying, well, we need a law to stop people saying this about me. Your approach was to get out there and make an argument and explain why your opponents were wrong and why people should vote for you and your agenda instead. And I think actually when people attack you or your agenda, it actually elevates you into the debate and can be of assistance rather than a negative. So, yeah, just interested in your personal experience with that.
Well, famously, Peter Costello and I did once take Bob Ellis, the late Bob Ellis, and his publisher to court over some factual claims that were not only incorrect but were pretty scurrilous in a book back in the late 90s. So I'm certainly not against the defamation laws. I'm not against the public nuisance laws. If people make claims that turn out to be false and which are damaging, well, you ought to be able to sue in the ordinary course of the tort law. So I'm not saying that there shouldn't be recourse when things that are wrong are done, but the idea that there should be some godlike authority accountable ultimately to no one, sitting in judgment on the ordinary claims that people make in the course of political discussion or disputation of some social issue, I just think is wrong. Now, I mean, let's go back to the pandemic for a moment. Many of the things that would have been branded misinformation at the height of the pandemic, we now know to be true. Mm-hmm. And just imagine if some Big Brother censor had been there scouring the internet to a greater extent than big tech was doing this anyway. Mm-hmm. Just imagine if it was even worse with some Big Brother censor saying, oh, you're not allowed to argue against masks, that's misinformation. You're not allowed to argue against vaccine mandates, that's misinformation. You're not allowed to argue that COVID is not really that more serious than a particularly severe flu. that's misinformation. I mean, it would have made our actions in response to this thing even more problematic than they turned out to be.
Just before I let you go, and without notice, I want to ask you about the idea of fixed terms, four-year mm-hmm. fixed terms mm-hmm. for federal parliament. So I know earlier in the week at the, I think it was the Australian Financial Review Business Summit, both Anthony Albanese and Peter Dutton supported the idea of four-year fixed terms. I can't remember who first floated it, but it's supported by both sides of politics federally. Now, they are in place, I think, in pretty much every state across Australia. I personally oppose them because I see it as a way of the political class trying to get out of having more frequent elections mm-hmm. when, if anything, we should have... I know Australians don't like going to the polls, mm-hmm. but I think at this point in our nation's history, we need to probably have more elections and more referenda rather than fewer. I'm just interested in your thoughts and perspective.
Well, Dan, I'm with you. I think we need more democracy, not less democracy. I think we need more engagement of the people, not less engagement of the people. I think that if the public were more engaged, we would have a much better polity, and I think it would be good for the citizenry as well. I've always taken the view that if there's a bad government, an election can't come soon enough. Mm-hmm. And if it's a good government, it shouldn't be scared of an election. So I certainly would not be in favour of any change towards four-year fixed terms.
Okay, Tony, great. Thanks for that. On that note, we'll close it off there. So thanks for your time. Greatly appreciate it. And we'll have another chat in about 2 weeks' time.
I look forward to it, Dan.
Thanks, Tony. This is a production of the Centre for the Australian Way of Life at the Institute of Public Affairs. To find out more, visit australia.ipa.org.au.